It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the creative minds behind the Wisconsin-made Star Wars parody web series, Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager.
First, representatives from nearly 200 countries reached an agreement this week committing to taking on climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Leaders reached the landmark deal after a couple of weeks of negotiations in Paris, which calls for keeping the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100 and investing in renewable energy resources for developed and developing countries alike.
Many of the world leaders at the summit praised the deal for the steps it will take to curb climate change. Here's what President Obama said to the press shortly after the agreement.
This agreement sends a powerful signal that the world is firmly committed to a low-carbon future. And that has the potential to unleash investment and innovation in clean energy at a scale we have never seen before.
In spite of positive messages like that about the new plan, some critics say the measures won't do enough, others that it's going to cost too much.
Joining us now for more on the agreement is Richard Rood, professor of climate and space sciences at the University of Michigan. He follows the latest climate news on his Weather Underground blog, Dr. Ricky Rood's climate change blog. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we mentioned that the mood surrounding this agreement has been celebratory. After seeing the deal, do you think that leaders are justified in this excitement over what could be a historic moment for global climate change policy?
I'm just finishing up my next blog, and I've just finished reading the entire agreement. And I think it is a very exciting agreement, it's a very exciting moment. As I've gone through it, it feels a little bit like the moment of an intervention when we all realize that we have a problem. And now that we have this realization, it's like we can start to solve the problem now. But we have not solved the problem, and we've perhaps just really gotten to the starting line for what we need to do in order to address the problem.
And one of the major goals of that agreement is to keep the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. It's a 3-point-something degrees Fahrenheit. Why that 2 degrees Celsius number?
That number, 2 degrees Celsius, has been floating around for 15 or 20 years. And it's a number that some people have analyzed, and particularly, you might say, an analysis of economists and ecosystem folks, as well as potentially agricultural experts, which at a number like 2 degrees, it would be relatively straightforward for us to adapt to that. The number, again, has been around. It also became equated with the idea that 2 degrees was a number of dangerous climate change, and above 2 degrees it would be dangerous and our ability to cope or to adapt would be imperiled. It is a somewhat arbitrary number in that sense. I would also say it was a number that when people decided on it before, it was a number that they thought we could actually do.
Now, in the past, poor countries with developing economies were sometimes given a pass on meeting climate goals. How has that changed this time, and what does that change signify to you?
So I think one of the most important aspects going into Paris was this idea that countries would be declaring their intentions of what they would do about this problem. And more broadly, rather than the way the Kyoto Agreement was set up with sort of a top-down, perhaps management and regulatory approach, we've gone into this negotiations with more of national autonomy being important to folks and national self-determination. And I think that's an absolutely essential part of this. And part of this is this idea of who's exempt, who's not exempt. That sort of disappeared from the equation. There's not this idea of, you know, perhaps the heavy hand of government, and some people would say even the heavy hand of colonialism, having a broad impact. So I think it's this idea of self-determination, and though it, you know, has some risks, of course, you know, the voluntary nature of it is important that we have made this progress.
We're talking with climate expert Richard Rood from the University of Michigan now, talking about the landmark climate agreement that took place in Paris over the weekend. And let's look at the plan a little more closely. How are countries going to be held accountable for holding up their end of the bargain, for doing what they say they're going to do?
Well, you know, these are the sorts of things that are going to evolve over the years. Again, having just finished reading the document pretty much in its entirety, one of the things you're struck by is that we're going to keep coming back every 5 years. There are an enormous number of tasks that are already set out for 2015 to 2020. And I think that any sort of regulatory aspect of it is going to evolve over time. These things were not prescribed here in the beginning this time. So I think what we've done, again, we've recognized that we have a problem, and we're sort of setting up an agreement and a process that we're going to keep coming back every year and probably in the COPs and with very big sort of events every 5 years or so, where we will commit to more reductions as well as probably develop the protocols that deal with, let's say, any transgressions that might be occurring.
Now, as I understand it, the language of the agreement isn't something that's legally binding for the United States. Why wasn't legally binding language used?
I think that it's, you know, really not legally binding for anyone. I think you're faced with the problem, let's say, that if you have another treaty or something, you're going to have to take it, you know, to the Senate. And we know that a treaty on something like this will not make it very far in the, you know, in the Senate. You know, this was even true back during the Clinton administration with the Kyoto Protocol. It's something we signed but never ratified, and we never even took it to ratification. So I think part of that is the political reality. I think more broadly, virtually all nations are a little bit reluctant to hand over their autonomy to sort of legally binding treaties that have the enormous implications of something that really addresses all of the energy generation and use in the country.
So it sounds like one of the main things keeping countries on track will be what's sort of being dubbed name and shame. These countries have to announce how they're doing as they go along. And if they're not keeping up with their agreed upon standards, then there might be peer pressure from other nations.
I think absolutely. And I think aside from that sort of, I think you just called it name and shame, I think there is something different now than there was in 2009 in Copenhagen, which I think that individuals and countries are all realizing the real disruptive impacts of climate change that are already happening. Climate change is not something that is in the future anymore. The melting of ice in Greenland, the melting of permafrost in the Arctic, things like the big storm surge that came with Sandy and the rising sea level. I think these sorts of major impacts are something that both individuals and countries are beginning to internalize. So I think that, you know, on any given day, climate policy might be overwhelmed by energy security or national security, but I think climate change is going to emerge as sort of a constant issue that we're going to have to be thinking about in terms of, you know, how we behave both individually and as countries and as nations and, you know, and the entire planet.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was climate expert Richard Rood from the University of Michigan talking about the landmark climate agreement that took place in Paris over the weekend.
Han Solo is back in the new Star Wars movie opening this week. But before Harrison Ford ventured into a galaxy far, far away, he was a student at Ripon College. Dean Robbins tells us about Ford's years in Wisconsin.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away from Hollywood, future movie star Harrison Ford was coming of age in Wisconsin. He went to college here, discovered his love of performing, and got his first professional acting job. He also met and married his first wife. Perhaps most significantly, Ford developed his roguish reputation in the Badger State. That act came in handy for his breakthrough performance as Han Solo in 1977's Star Wars.
Let's get one thing straight. I take orders from just one person, me.
Harry Ford entered Ripon College in 1960 as a C student from the Chicago suburbs. He had no particular goals in college, so he drifted for 4 years. He signed up for ROTC, but left after refusing to cut his hair. He hustled money playing pool and lost interest in his philosophy major. By second semester of his senior year, he'd become thoroughly disrespectful, flunking out. Then a miracle occurred in central Wisconsin. Ford decided to take a theater class during his last quarter despite a bad case of stage fright. He donned a fake mustache and starred in The Skin of Our Teeth in Ripon's Red Barn Theater.
Oh, no, we're skipping this scene. Thanks.
By the end of the term, Harrison scarcely cared that he wouldn't graduate due to bad grades. He had found his calling, or so he thought. That summer, he decided to test the waters in his first professional acting job in Williams Bay. The Wisconsin Village had its own summer stock repertory company, the Belfry Players. Ford signed on as a resident actor, a low-paying gig that also required him to help out with carpentry. At the start of the summer season, Ford drove to Mequon to wed his college girlfriend, Mary Marquardt. Rather than go on a honeymoon, they headed back to Williams Bay so he could perform that night in Take Her, She's Mine. Mary got a job working in the Belfry Players box office, and the two lived together in a dormitory adjoining the theater.
Are you sure some of the other fellas don't want to come along?
Ford appeared in 6 plays. He occasionally flubbed lines and made a fool of himself.
I feel better already.
Still, he felt himself maturing as an actor. At the end of the summer, he and Mary packed up their old Volkswagen so Ford could try his luck in Hollywood. It took a little while, but he did indeed get lucky there. He scored huge hits with Star Wars and the Indiana Jones series.
Good afternoon, Dr. Jones.
He became the highest-grossing movie star of all time.
I ought to kill you right now.
Got a very private place for a murder?
In 1985, Ford was offered a more humble recognition, an honorary degree from Ripon. He declined, passing up the chance to finally become respectable in the state of Wisconsin. I guess you'd expect nothing less of Han Solo.
Dean Robbins is a writer in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Harrison Ford is not the only point of contact between Tatooine and Wisconsin. The Star Wars movies also inspired one of the best-known pop culture homages in the galaxy. Created here in Wisconsin, the web series Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager follows the trivial day-to-day events of Darth Vader's lesser-known middling brother, Chad.
I am the day manager of this facility. What is the nature of your distress?
I bought these chips here and they're stale.
Yes. I can feel your anger. It is strong inside you.
I want my money back.
Release your anger. Only your hatred can destroy me.
Yeah. Can I talk to someone else?
Strike me down with your hate and claim your refund.
Did I say these were stale? I think they're great.
Weak-minded fool. Your powers are nothing compared to
mine. Vader to aisle 5 for vomit cleanup. Chad to aisle 5 for vomit.
And joining us now are the co-creators of the Chad Vader web series, Aaron Yonda and Matt Sloan. Aaron, Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Chad Vader web series debuted in, 2006, I believe, has millions of YouTube views now. What did you like about the concept of centering a series around the character of Darth Vader's loser brother, a guy named Chad?
I think it's just a lot of fun to bring humor and comedy to that persona. And, you know, there's that incongruity is just great fodder for comedy. And I think that's really what attracted us to it originally.
In a way, it seems like a minor miracle that this thing happened at all, because I thought that Lucasfilms was notoriously tight-fisted with its property, the Star Wars franchise. How did you get over that hurdle?
It just turned out that George Lucas really liked what we made, and he let us live, basically. He just sort of he gave us the Fan Film Award in 2007. And he was always surprisingly nice about it, and we've had a good relationship with it. So,
yeah. Have you ever met him?
No. No, we met some of the executives at Lucasfilm, but
he said our names.
He did. He made a joke out of mine. He said, "Aaron Yoda."
Oh, very nice. Uh-huh, that can't be coincidence, right?
No.
So the Chad Vader suit, if you've seen the web series, it's pretty impressive. It doesn't look like the kind of thing you're going to pick up at Costume Depot somewhere. Where'd you get the suit?
It was, we've gone through about 3 suits, and we got them all online just at costume stores.
It's the officially licensed Darth Vader costume.
Deluxe rubies.
Is it really nice if you're wearing it? Can you see that this is quality?
It's pretty nice. It's pretty nice. What's weird is we've gone through 3, and they subtly changed the costume over the years. They made the gloves different, and they made certain parts not quite as sturdy as they used to be. And, when Chad does his falling routines and stunts, and certain parts will break that didn't used to break.
Parts of Darth are breaking off.
Yeah, he looks a little worse for wear these days.
Yeah, he does.
Okay, so Aaron, you're the guy in the suit. Mm-hmm. Right, and Matt, you are the voice.
Yes.
Along with his arch nemesis at the store, Randy, right?
Clint.
Clint, excuse me. Randy is the other guy. But you are the voice of Darth Vader, and this is something that has been pretty amazing for you. You've gotten to do some video games voicing Darth, haven't you?
Yep. Video games, commercials, talking toothbrushes, and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Well, we can't let you leave without giving us a sample. So we have some very exciting copy for you to read.
Oh, yes.
In the voice of Darth Vader.
Why, here it is. There is processing involved in the Darth Vader voice, so that will be absent for this, but I will I'll do my best.
Understood.
All right. A new El Nino is shaping up to be the biggest in nearly 20 years. It may bring warmer temperatures to Wisconsin this winter, affecting agriculture, wildlife, and all the ways we work and play outside. Learn more about it at wpr.org/El Nino.
Wow.
It is your destiny.
Wow, I bet people are going to tune in for that. They have to. It is their destiny. Did that voice come naturally, or did you have to work on it for a while?
It came pretty naturally. We watched the movies. We had the DVDs, and we just watched all the Darth Vader scenes, which is a lot of fun to do. And then it just kind of came out. And, it's been refined over the years, but it came pretty naturally, yeah.
Yeah, I understand in the Pantheon, you're not the only guy who does Darth Vader, but you're one of the cream of the crop for this voice, as I understand it.
Yeah, I'm sort of the official guy for when, someone wants to license the voice from Lucasfilm, they contact me, so.
So how does it feel to live in this Star Wars universe? You're not living in, not the way, say, Mark Hamill or J.J. Abrams, who's directing the new movie, are living in that. But what does it feel like to live in the Star Wars universe?
Well, it's great. I mean, the first Chad Vader episode is actually on a Blu-ray release of the original 3 movies. And so it's just amazing to be a very small part of this massive thing known as Star Wars and, an honor in many ways.
Are you guys going to go see the movie? Do you have tickets?
Oh, yes.
You've got your tickets. Are you going opening? Well, it's premiering tonight in L.A. When does it start here?
I think Thursday screenings. I'm going on Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I'm going to a Friday matinee as well.
And I have to stay off Facebook for the entirety of Thursday until after I see the movie.
Facebook blackout. So were the two of you super fans growing up?
Yeah, I would say I was a huge fan. I had all kinds of figures.
Any man from our generation is pretty much a super fan of Star Wars.
Or woman.
So. Yeah, yes.
Just saying. Well, we've got about a minute. I'm going to put your nerdery to a test here.
Oh, boy.
There are no prizes associated with this, only glory.
Ah.
If any. There may be some glory. So let's see how you do on this. Okay. First one, this is kind of a softball. Why do the sand people walk single file?
to hide their numbers.
So good. Aaron, would you have gotten that? You looked a little confused.
No.
All right, this one's a little harder. Maybe this is a Matt one. Luke said he used a bullseye, a particular animal on Tatooine that wasn't much bigger than the target on the Death Star that they were shooting for. Name that animal.
That would be a womp
rat.
Yes.
Very good. All right, well, how much bigger? What was in meters? What was it?
2 meters.
Again, Matt is 3 for 3. Aaron, a little less good. That's
Matt has a really good memory.
We don't judge. What species was Greedo? Final question. This comes from Rob Ferret. I did not know this.
The species of shooting first.
True, and also...
I always understood that he was a Greedo, but I'm sure that's not correct.
It is not. He's not a Greedo. He is, in fact, Rodian.
Oh.
But that was respectable.
Oh. Okay.
Thank you for playing. I award you
glory. That last one was too tough.
That's Rob's fault. He's a super nerd, too. All right, well, guys, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having us.
That was Aaron Yanda and Matt Sloan, co-creators of the popular web series Chad Vader, Day Shift Manager. We're talking about the Star Wars franchise starting up again.
Tomorrow is the deadline for signing up to receive health insurance by January 1st under the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin is one of 20 states that have not expanded Medicaid under that law, one of 27 states that hasn't set up its own health care exchange.
As the country wraps up its registrations for the coming year, Citizen Action of Wisconsin has a report that finds that Wisconsinites pay thousands of dollars more on average than Minnesotans for health care. Minnesota has a similar population to Wisconsin, but has both expanded Medicaid and set up its own health exchange.
Here with us now to talk about the report is Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
So on average, how much more are Wisconsinites paying for health care than our neighbors in Minnesota?
And we looked at premiums and deductibles because people are seeing a lot of pain with deductibles as well. And it was huge last year, 43% more in Wisconsin than Minnesota. This year, it's 47% more for the most popular silver plan on the federal marketplace. And so our rates are going up far, far more than Minnesota's, especially if you take into account deductibles, which actually went up 46% since last year in Wisconsin and were flat in Minnesota this year.
And we're focusing here just on coverage under the Affordable Care Act when we're talking about these numbers. Is that right?
We are. We're talking about insurance people buying their own on the new marketplace. So we'll do a comprehensive report at the end of the year about overall costs, but these costs are very comparable. In other words, Wisconsin is much higher across the board than Minnesota. So this isn't an aberration just within Affordable Care Act plans at all.
And as I understand it, healthcare costs a little more in Wisconsin than Minnesota before the Affordable Care Act was a reality. Have things diverged more since then?
They seem to be diverging more, and the reason is that Minnesota has actually built on the Affordable Care Act and done additional things. They obviously took the federal Medicaid money, the badge care money in Wisconsin. By not taking that, we think that increases our rates about 10% because more people end up in emergency rooms without health insurance and the costs get shifted. In addition, they have done things like rate review, where they're doing very strict rate review, looking at insurance company rate increases and making the insurance companies justify their rate increases. In Wisconsin, we've taken a very lax approach, and a bill to do that in the legislature has not even gotten a hearing in Wisconsin.
I've seen state officials say that we haven't done that, the idea being that there's enough competition in the marketplace that that would naturally lower those insurance costs without the state imposing caps or rejecting rate increases.
It doesn't help you if all of the choices you have are much higher than, say, neighboring Minnesota. And so competition alone is not doing it at all. All rate review does is, we do it with utility rates already, is make the insurance companies justify the rate increases. And by the way, if they can justify them, if they're based on underlying medical costs, then we need to go look at providers, look at prescription drug costs, look at other factors. But the fact is, our state has been kind of frozen in time, where our governor and our state legislature's health care plan is simply to undermine the Affordable Care Act and fight over and over again the debate of 5 years ago, rather than moving forward and doing what consumers want, which is to focus on costs.
So let's connect the dots. You say part of the reason here is that Minnesota took the Medicaid expansion, Wisconsin didn't. How does that ultimately translate into higher costs for coverage under the Affordable Care Act here?
And there are two factors. The RAND Corporation did a study that said that states that did not take the money have 10% on average higher costs. One reason is if you have more uninsured people, they end up sick in the emergency room without coverage. That cost gets shifted onto private insurance. Another reason is when insurance is too expensive for people, people who are motivated, people who have a lot of health conditions, they'll pay even if they can barely afford it, whereas people who are healthier will not, and therefore the risk pool for insurance becomes bigger as well, sicker, and therefore more costly, which raises everyone else's rates. So turning down the BadgerCare money not only is horrendous for all the people who don't have affordable coverage, should have it. It's not only horrendous because it's really harming the state budget, $400 million in this budget, but it also is raising private health insurance rates for everyone else.
And the state, the governor in particular, has justified not taking that money, saying, yeah, it'd be great this year, but a lot of things change at the federal level. We can't trust them to continue funding it. We might overcommit and then not be able to pay for it without that federal money. Does that make sense to you?
It's a complete red herring. This is some of the most safe federal money. It's a mandatory spending that has to be repealed by Congress, and the president has to sign a bill repealing it. The governor took $14 billion in federal money. A lot of it has to be approved every year by Congress. And so that's simply a smokescreen. What's really happening here is ideological and political. It has nothing to do with protecting taxpayers at all. And in fact, it actually costs federal taxpayers more, because when people are forced onto the federal marketplace, they use private insurance, which costs a lot more than BadgerCare does.
Talking to Robert Craig from Citizen Action of Wisconsin about a new report out from that group comparing health care costs in Wisconsin versus Minnesota. Costs for coverage under the Affordable Care Act they find significantly higher in Wisconsin than Minnesota, and in comparable cities as well, Wisconsin higher than in Minnesota. Robert, we've looked at a couple of the things you point to as causes, not directly regulating insurance costs, not taking that Medicaid expansion money. Also, you look at the impact of one state, Minnesota, setting up its own exchange under the Affordable Care Act, Wisconsin not, just relying on the federal model. Does that make a difference?
It begins to. It actually will make a bigger difference moving forward. Minnesota just started going to active purchasing, which is literally trying to negotiate for medical rates, and that will reduce rates further. What you're having your own marketplace or exchange allows you to do is allows you to innovate. It allows you to try to do innovations in the medical system that would increase prevention, chronic disease management, other things that keep people well and therefore reduce higher cost specialty care. So the real impact of Minnesota's exchange or marketplace hasn't really kicked in yet. So the gap could get worse unless Wisconsin gets on the ball and starts focusing on actually improving the healthcare system.
Now, in Minnesota, they've got the big metro area, the Twin Cities. As I understand, it's home to about 60% of the state's population. So there's this concentrated population in a small area, maybe bringing lots more competition in healthcare, maybe driving down costs for a significant part of the state's population. Does that factor into the difference in costs, Minnesota versus Wisconsin?
Well, it's clear the Twin Cities is the cheapest area in Minnesota, so there is something going on there. But if you look at overall costs across the state and even the rural regions, Wisconsin is higher than Minnesota. But quite frankly, the medical underlying medical costs in the Twin Cities are not clearly higher. It's the insurance costs that are lower. In other words, there seems to be distortion also in the insurance market going on. But when we look at cost, which is just a huge issue moving forward, we need as states to look at all the lever points we have, not only the ones we just mentioned, but things like regulating prescription drug prices, things like surprise medical bills. The public is really getting concerned about cost, and I think states that don't do anything like Wisconsin are going to fall further and further behind a state like Minnesota.
I want to dig a little deeper into some of the costs in your report. It's not, as I look at the numbers in Wisconsin, it's not consistent from one place to another. Who around the state has the highest insurance costs in Wisconsin as compared to Minnesota?
Yeah, so in this report, and we'll do a comprehensive report at the end of the year about this, the real high-cost areas are places like Wausau, Stevens Point, which are over $5,000 higher than Minnesota. Racine is over $5,000 higher. Milwaukee's $4,953 higher. So those are the higher-cost areas. Madison and Janesville, Beloit are the lowest-cost areas. They're higher than Minnesota, but they're lower than the rest of the state. And that's consistent with about 8 years of research we've been doing, which shows huge disparities within the state of Wisconsin, which makes a higher-cost place, like a Wausau, like an Eau Claire, less competitive compared to a Madison. So it's a real problem within the state that we have these disparities for exactly the same kind kind of coverage. The great thing about the Affordable Care Act is we now can compare apples to apples. We can look at exactly the same kind of coverage, see what costs in different states or in different cities within the same state.
What accounts for that difference within the state?
There are a lot of different theories as to why. Some has to do with whether you have integrated medical systems that are actually competing with each other. In other words, where the medical system owns the insurance plan and therefore has a kind of an incentive to have lower costs and higher quality. Madison has that characteristic where you have integrated plans, which are integrated medical providers, which also sell the insurance. It seems that places that have more commercial insurance are more expensive, where it's a commercial insurer providing all of the various medical providers in the area. So a Milwaukee, therefore, is traditionally much more expensive than a Madison. But obviously, there are huge disparities that we need to look at as a matter of state policy. And one of our big points in this report and previous reports is we need to dig into this as a state. And in fact, it's not even on the radar screen in Madison. I even talk about health insurance costs, where it's one of the biggest public concerns out there if you travel the state.
And I want to look at some border communities. You compared cities on either side of the Wisconsin-Minnesota state line. What did you find when you did that?
You found dramatic differences. You found that a Duluth was substantially less expensive than Superior just over the border, and you found a Rochester, Minnesota, less expensive than a La Crosse. And the biggest gap we, of course, have found consistently is between Minneapolis, right over the river there, and Hudson, right on the Wisconsin side. And so there's a real problem there with people if they move into the Wisconsin side, even if they work in Minnesota, they're paying much higher health insurance costs if they're on the Wisconsin side buying insurance in Wisconsin.
We're talking to Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. A report from his group shows that Wisconsinites pay on average thousands more than Minnesotans for health care for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The deadline to sign up for insurance under the ACA and get covered by January 1st is tomorrow.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How have your health care costs changed in recent years? Do you think that Wisconsin should expand Medicaid or set up its own health care exchange? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. A report from his group shows that Wisconsinites pay on average thousands more for their health care than Minnesotans.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's fair to compare Wisconsin with Minnesota? Should Wisconsin consider expanding Medicaid or setting up its own health care coverage exchange? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've bought coverage under the Affordable Care Act, like to hear what kind of options you had. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Deanna on the line in Wausau. Deanna, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say that as someone who has been on Badger Care and then needed to go to the marketplace and has now just as of the beginning of the year will be on my employer's insurance, the only option that I have in northern Wisconsin, north of Wausau, is actually Security Health.
And you have no other options to choose from, Deanna?
There is no other option. You have to choose one of the Security Health plans no matter where you're at.
Deanna, thanks a lot for that call. So, Robert, that's part of the story in parts of Wisconsin, not many options for care?
Yeah, and I know she's talking about the marketplace or at her workplace, but there aren't a whole lot of options in Wausau generally. Security Health is connected to Marshfield Clinic, and it is actually relatively high quality but relatively high cost, which, of course, is a problem. So there are fewer options the further away you go from Madison and Milwaukee, but having all the options you have in Milwaukee hasn't lowered costs here either. So it's not just a matter of options, but that's definitely one factor.
Is there a problem with the Affordable Care Act itself that maybe didn't get enough companies to join in the program to compete on this marketplace at the federal level?
We've actually had a lot more choices in Wisconsin than a lot of other states. There were a number of states where there was only one insurance provider. You do have some big for-profit insurance companies like UnitedHealthcare threatening to pull out of the marketplace. Our opinion would be, since the compromise was to allow private insurance companies in these marketplaces in order to reduce opposition, that we need to create a strong public option to make sure people have choices in places they do not. And that's something Wisconsin has the option to do starting in 2017. And so if private insurance can't do it, then we should provide something like Medicare so that everyone has a good choice. And so we have some bargaining leverage to get these rising health medical prices down.
Deanna, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Jane in Wauwatosa. Jane, hi.
Hi there. I'm enjoying the conversation. Your guest's information is very enlightening. However, I'm definitely not surprised by it. I'm a small business owner. I have insurance for two people in my family, and my premiums went from $686 to it's going to increase by about $30 this year. But as an aside, as a small business owner, I think about the money that I'm spending on premiums that I could be investing in growing my business or providing more opportunities and benefits for my employees. So I am in favor of expansion of the Medicaid program and or setting up our own exchange.
And Jane, before I let you go, as a compare and contrast, were you in business before the Affordable Care Act came into effect? And did you see higher premium increases then versus now? Or are things pretty much the same or worse?
I actually was with my small business. I was employed and growing my business. So
gotcha.
I was insured by an employer. So I can't speak to that.
Great. Thanks a lot for calling in, Jane. And Robert, first of all, to her point she sees if she had better coverage, better options, lower premiums at her small business for herself and her employees, she could be putting that money into economic development, into growing her business.
I think that's right, and that's why healthcare costs are such a major concern. And the Affordable Care Act didn't end our discussion of price, but it created a kind of a floor where everyone has somewhere to go no matter what, so it ended discrimination, but it put in the states in a position to build on that foundation. And Wisconsin's not doing that. So Jane is absolutely right. It's pulling money out of the economy to have continually rising health insurance costs and medical costs. She also should be given credit. Only a third of small businesses in Wisconsin can afford to provide health insurance coverage to their employees. And that is a major problem, and there is nothing on the state agenda to cope with that, that not only harms those small businesses and people in them, it makes them less competitive, so they lose employees to larger businesses that can afford to provide coverage. So it's really bad for the growth of our small business sector in Wisconsin.
Robert, I know in the pre-Affordable Care Act days and part of the justification given for passing the law, premiums are going up pretty quickly for health care coverage for businesses and others. Have we seen that get better since the main parts of this law came into effect?
We've seen historically low increases nationally, but the problem is those increases have been on a much higher base. In other words, after a huge run-up in costs. For the last, since the year 2000, where they've gone up over 200% in Wisconsin. This is before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So we're starting at a very high level. The Affordable Care Act didn't do as much for costs as it did for coverage and guaranteeing that everyone has somewhere else to go. And it was supposed to come in the second stage and in the stage where states did things. And we've been stalled by this very divisive debate, quite frankly, where a part of our political establishment has wanted to repeal it over and over and over again rather than moving forward. And I think the way this is going to change is even people who opposed quote-unquote Obamacare have come to the conclusion that it's here to stay, it's been upheld twice by the Supreme Court, and that we need to get down to the business of making the system better and focusing on cost. And I think that politicians who get in the way of that are increasingly going to be damaged by this issue, because this is one of the top issues in the country and in this state.
Talking to Robert Craig with Citizen Action of Wisconsin. A new report from his group shows that Wisconsinites pay on average thousands more for their health care than people across the border in Minnesota. Our number is 800-642-1234 if you want to join in. Robert, do you see anything changing? It doesn't seem like Medicaid expansion is really even talked about in Wisconsin for the most part. Forming our own exchange doesn't seem likely. The insurance regulation you talked about earlier, do you think anything could change that would make that gap less wide between the costs here in Wisconsin and over in Minnesota?
I think we're at the verge of a change, potentially. I think that the 2016 election is the last gasp of the repeal efforts. You have presidential candidates, Republican side, running on repeal, but talking about it less and less because the public's gotten sick of the divisive debate. And once it becomes not partisan in that way, it becomes obvious, for example, you should take the Medicaid money. We had a conservative state last week, South Dakota, take the money. And Wisconsin, it's a little bit hard to figure out how Governor Walker puts forward a balanced budget in 2017 without taking the Badger Care money. So I think things are beginning to change, and that this election may be the last gasp of the repeal efforts, and then we can just get to work on building on the system, not going backwards, not going back to days of discrimination, but really focusing on cost, because it's not just, in Wisconsin, nationally we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and it's a huge drag on our quality of life and on our economy.
Go back to our callers. Dave is on the line in Appleton. Dave, hi.
Hi. It amazes me how people look only within their own family or their own self in terms of their costs. The only true measure of cost, and I agree we have to focus on cost, the only true measure of cost is the percent of GDP. We're at about 17.4% in the U.S. compared to about 12% worldwide for countries that have equal or superior results. So everything else is how the pie is cut up, who wins, who loses, how companies shift the cost of policies to employees. Employees think that Obamacare is raising their cost. Or whatever, when actually what's happening is the 17.4%
Gotcha. We're losing your line a little, Dave, but the point he's making, Robert, we pay proportionally more for health care than other comparable countries, and that getting those health care costs under control would be the most important thing to do. Are we doing that at all, Robert?
We really have not taken it on. We pay double per capita what any other country pays in the world for health insurance. We don't cover everyone, though we're getting better on that. And so at about a third of medical spending in the U.S. is waste. It's not value-added because we have a fragmented system that kind of prioritizes expensive specialty care once people are already sick rather than keeping them well, doing preventive care, doing chronic disease management. We charge them huge deductibles for drugs they need to stay on their chronic disease measurements, and then when they can't pay them and get off of them, it costs tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to deal with the consequence, and that happens across the whole system. And so the caller's absolutely right that we need to reform our whole system, and that's the next big frontier on healthcare reform. And we need to get to that and get beyond the initial debate we've had since 2010 about whether we should repeal a law which is a step forward and which ends the kind of discrimination that no one believes in. That is being thrown off insurance if denied coverage just because you were sick or have had health conditions.
Well, that cost control effort sounded to be another huge political battle, just like the Affordable Care Act was. As we wrap up, do you think that anybody, Democrats or Republicans, have the appetite to do something like that?
I think it's going to take a firestorm from the public to do it. You have large vested interests. You have the drug companies. You have the insurance companies. You have a lot of these healthcare systems, which are the hospital systems, which are nonprofit in name only, and they have a huge amount of lobbying power. So the only way anything ever changes in our society is if the public gets so fed up that they light a fire under politicians and make it an issue they vote on in elections. And I think we're getting to that point, but that's the only thing that's going to change things. If it's left to kind of to the back stairs of the Capitol, then the lobbyists will win out.
Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
That was Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. A report from his group shows that Wisconsinites pay more than Minnesotans for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Sign-up deadline tomorrow to get coverage by January 1st.